Hello and welcome back to the Dive and Dig podcast. This week is the fourth and final episode of our climate threat mini-series. This week I'm going to be talking to Dr. Alex Kent, who heads up the Coastal Connections Project, a partnership between the World Monuments Fund and English Heritage. This initiative aims to bring awareness to the threat faced by coastal sites across the globe. Here is Alex to tell us a bit more. Alex, thank you so much for coming to talk to me on the Dive and Dig podcast. I don't know if you're aware, but we're doing a little mini-series around coastal sites and the threat of climate change. Now, I know that the initiative, I guess, that you work for is slightly broader than that, but I've really been fascinated by the work that you've been doing with this Coastal Connections Network, and I wanted to share some of that with the listeners to see, A, what you're doing and what, you know, where this was conceived from, but also how this has sort of impact and resonance for the issues around coastal heritage sites and climate impact. So tell us a little bit about Coastal Connections, will you, Alex, please?
Thank you. Thank you so much, Lucy. It's great to be here, and thanks for the invitation. And I'm always keen to talk about Coastal Connections because it is such a fantastic project. And I think there's so much that we can learn as well from one another in sharing the common challenges that we face, which is really what Coastal Connections is all about. So it all started really with the, I suppose, a bit of a negative occasion, which was the collapse of part of the Eastern Battery of Hurst Castle in February 2021. And after that occurred, English Heritage then nominated the castle. This is Hurst Castle, which is in the south of England, just above the Isle of Wight. English Heritage then nominated the castle to the 2022 Watch, and the Watch is something that World Monuments Fund runs every couple of years to really highlight the significance of places, treasure places that are at risk around the world, significant places. And so following that nomination, the idea then was to say how we could perhaps share some of these lessons learned from Hurst Castle and other places around the world, really the coastal heritage sites that are at risk, so that we can understand not just how to overcome some of the common challenges, but look at solutions, share knowledge exchange, and also really to really engage with those places that might be a little bit more isolated and remote, so that people could really see that there was hope. So really it's a story of wisdom and hope.
In terms of Coastal Connections, I understand it's a combination between World Monuments Fund and English Heritage, which is a great initiative. And so how has Coastal Connections sort of mapped out over the course of, I think it's 2 years it's been going now?
Yes, that's right. So initially, the aim really was to build a network, and it still is, to build a network of sites around the globe that face challenges, largely to do with the impacts of climate change. And what we realised in looking at really coastal heritage and how people are sharing solutions is that there's very little, I suppose, in literature there about the individual case studies, the impacts of climate change specifically on coastal heritage. So we wanted to build this network and then build a library of case studies so that people could understand what the issues were that were really being faced at these different sites around the world. And the way that we decided to really embark on all of this to kind of create a way that we could come together was to, I suppose, two different methods really. One was to reach out to existing sites that were in English Heritage within their network and within World Monuments Fund, that covers a lot of sites around the globe. Remember, we've been working in about 700 sites, 700 projects around the globe, 112 countries. So there's quite a big scope in that way, but also to then try and find some other sites that were perhaps underrepresented as well. So to reach out to them, to reach out to their site managers and talk to them and find out what they would find very useful about coming together. So that was one approach. And the other approach was more of a data-driven, GIS-led approach, geographical information systems, that is, looking at maps and also combining those with other climate data to do with coastal flooding, for example, to try and isolate places and identify those around the world that were facing similar types of problems to do with sea level rise, and then reaching out to coastal heritage sites in those areas to say, this is a network we're building, would you like to join us and find out what we're doing and find out what other people are doing? So it's really, in a way, sort of a combination of being top down and bottom up. But the themes that we then derived from those conversations, for example, one was communities and intergenerational stewardship. Another one was mapping, modelling, monitoring. Another one was to do with underwater and intertidal heritage. These themes came about from the conversations we had with those site managers. And we really wanted to get to the bottom of what it was, the key issues, the key themes that really interested them. And so once we got to that stage, we then devised a series of workshops. Initially, we had 6 workshops that then ran to 7 and then to 10 eventually over this last year. Each of those workshops bringing together a series of about 3 or 4 speakers, each of them talking about one or more case studies from around the world. And then, I suppose, rather critically, following those talks, we then had a discussion, roundtable discussion online, so that then anyone who was either a site manager or who cared for coastal heritage, because these were open invitations to anyone could join them. The idea then was to have those discussions and really facilitate, and that was the key thing really, facilitate new connections between different people from around the world that would be caring for sites that were located along the coast, particularly obviously those at risk. So we had a huge range of themes, so 10 different themes and a huge range of talks, so probably about 50 talks. And again, the network is about 50 sites in the network, just over 50 sites. So there's a huge range of case studies. And of course, what we found within that as well was just the commonality of the issues that people face. So there's a huge potential for sharing those issues and also those solutions.
You see, that's the bit that I find particularly interesting. Because, you know, I have to admit, when I first heard about this, I was a bit sceptical, if I'm perfectly honest, about, you know, how these common threats would actually map out on the ground, because we're, you know, globally you're dealing with very different sort of geographical contexts, etc. But I think that's really fascinating that you took these two different approaches in a way. One was to sort of identify common landscapes, in effect, whether they're, you know, global, north, south, whatever, but also asking people what are the issues, asking people, you know, what they see as the biggest challenges to managing sites. And that's a really, really quite an inspired approach. And I mean, I know, because I've taken part in some of these, that it is a really stimulating and effective way of communicating. So you say there's been over around 50 talks. How many, you know, in terms of the network of people that you've brought together, how many different institutions, individuals, countries, I don't know?
Yeah, so we've engaged with over 700 people, individuals, and over 80 countries, which is fantastic news. And I think that really reflects the demand that there is for sharing this sort of information, and maybe more importantly, the relevance that people find in sharing that knowledge and that information around the world. So as you're saying, and, you know, I come at this from geographical perspective, certainly as a geographer, and again, I probably shared your scepticism at the beginning, thinking, to what extent would there be that commonality? You know, the obvious thing would be to say, you've got a site like Hurst Castle. What could that learn from somewhere like Rapa Nui and Easter Island? You know, it's or Easter Island. So you know, and again, what you then find is actually once you start talking to people, that actually the issues they face are quite similar, to do with coast erosion, to do with concerns about sea level rise, to do with more frequent storms or frequent storm surges that are getting more violent and unpredictable, this sort of thing. You find this happening all sorts of places around the world. And even though the individual physical geography of each of these places, and obviously the historic significance, is going to be unique and different in these places, actually you find some of the issues they face are very, very similar. And again, you know, just to take an example, we had one of our first workshops where we were looking at nature-based solutions, and we were looking at hard engineering solutions as well. And just the ability we had, or the capacity, I suppose, to join up sites like Priddy's Hard in Gosport, where there are concerns about sea level rise and this sort of thing, with Fort Berkeley in Antigua. And again, similar sorts of issues there, where you have a busy working harbour, both sides of the Atlantic, very different climatic conditions, but actually facing quite similar threats and similar, I suppose, worries from an economic standpoint as well as a physical geography one as well. But I think at the heart of all of this, and the key thing is, and it sort of touches your point, Lucy, you made at the beginning, really, it's not about any one site telling another site what to do. So it's not about the West, if you like, or the global North saying, we know the answers. We want to tell you what to do in the global South. It's a case of saying, actually, you know, what are the actual approaches, perspectives, for example, on the renewal of heritage and this sort of thing? How you cope with loss, for example. What can we learn in the West and in the global North from the global South? Very much as the case of everything else. So it really is about openly sharing lessons learned wherever people come from, because we feel that there's a huge amount that we can all learn if we're facing common challenges.
I couldn't agree more. But it's also interesting, just to return to the theme, that the things you listed as common threats, Hurst Castle, you know, being the first one, it very much connects to, even if it's in one instance where it becomes very real, what I would list as some of the biggest challenges that are climate threat driven, if you see what I mean. Did you find that was a very much a common theme? I mean, it's the things you listed. Is it the top of the list of most people's concerns about threat?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the impacts of climate change on heritage is really sort of the keynote theme of coastal connections. That's where we find people facing all over the world similar challenges in terms of sea level rise, frequent storms and so on that I've already mentioned. So those are the common issues, I think, if you see that people face that, we feel there is really a lack of case studies, a lack of sharing, which we've tried to address with coastal connections. But rather interestingly, what we discovered as we ran the programme about halfway through is that, I suppose, there are a couple of things. Firstly, that we started to get more sites that were interested in joining the network that weren't exclusively, and whether you really can say this, exclusively cultural heritage sites. So we started this programme thinking this would be about cultural heritage. And actually, we started to realise that, again, it's not just about cultural heritage. We need to look beyond the historical site itself, but also natural sites as well, wanting to get more involved, because actually for a lot of the natural sites, funny enough, they're already further down the line in terms of how they deal with issues and some of these impacts, particularly if they're dealing with loss of habitats. And it's really an artificial separation if we think about the cultural and the, you know, and the natural.
Are you finding solutions? I know it's hard because we're in the coastal zone, but
yeah, I think the key thing is all about, you know, how we are open, more and more open to the breadth of solutions that are out there, and to get people thinking that actually, if there are sites that are facing similar challenges, can we consider some of those solutions? But it might be a case, therefore, not just in terms of thinking about the practical solutions, but also in terms of the approaches. And that's why approaches to perhaps understanding loss and seeing loss not necessarily as a negative thing, but as a transformative, positive thing. And thinking about how sites could maybe encompass perhaps more of a natural habitat over time, so that their management takes on board more of a holistic approach, so that we think about the benefits of biodiversity over time, rather than it purely being about protecting a particular site. And so I suppose the interesting thing is that you start to see how, for example, within the UK, we're very much about protecting heritage. And this is why protecting coastal heritage is particularly difficult taking the long term, because it always needs to be reconsidered and remanaged, rebuilt and so on. So maybe taking a longer term view that says, well, actually, what are the benefits perhaps of not protecting over time? Would that actually be a preferable thing to do, given the finite resources that we've got and so on? So I think there are, you know, a range of solutions that are the nature-based solutions that can help in terms of understanding, well, in terms of curbing erosion, but those might not all be, you know, the preferable thing to do. It might be preferable to actually think about how we see maybe releasing, let's say, the creative capital that we have in a lot of our coastal towns and cities, to perhaps get us to see our coastal heritage in new and fresh and exciting ways, rather than perhaps just valuing the heritage of the past. I think we have to be mindful of that.
I think that's really interesting, both of those points, because, I mean, from my own experience, that conversation that you said, it's not just about recognising the nature base, but also some of the traditions that are inherent, you know, around the world that it sort of effectively managed these sites or the coastlines, but which a lot of them have been lost. So that's that knowledge base as well as that sort of application. So where is this all going? I know that, unfortunately, the first phase is coming to an end. I'm hoping there's a second phase. Do you have any plans for future coastal connections?
I hope so. Yeah, well, it's very interesting. It's been so fascinating to see how we've made these connections across the world and to understand the different solutions and the different issues that people face. And I guess the way that we've approached coastal connections with phase one is very much a kind of a sort of broad but maybe shallow approach. So we've looked at how we can identify similar places around the world and then get those connected and understand, I suppose, better the approaches that they're taking. And I guess what we're realising more and more is, I suppose, that a different tack going forward, a sort of evolution, is probably needed, where we showcase and examine and facilitate conversations on a perhaps a more regional level. So we look at different regions of the world that are facing similar issues. And so again, we look to facilitate connections within those regions, and then potentially also to develop training hubs within those regions, so that we can not only share solutions with those people that can perhaps best implement them within the same sort of climatic conditions and same physical geographies. But also, I think the other side of this, which is really important, is that quite often a lot of the underrepresented sites that we might see within those regions may have very, very innovative solutions and approaches that need to have their stories told at a more global level. So what we really want to do is to continue that global level of conversations at the same time, so that we can then showcase some of these regional solutions that we've discovered. I mean, ultimately, it is in that sort of hands-on, practical, face-to-face, in-person transfer of skills, because not only is that really, really useful in terms of, you know, equipping people with the skills they need to better manage their heritage more sustainably, we're really keen on supporting traditional knowledge and traditional practices and this sort of thing. But rather crucially, it's that cross-generational aspect of what we're doing as well. We did have a workshop on this, but that just shows why it's so important to do this, to ensure that there are next new generations coming forward that know how to manage heritage sustainably. And that would be a great, great legacy, I think, of the project going forward, just geographically as well as historically as well, I think.
Oh, that's really fascinating. Well, I'm really, really grateful for you just speaking to me. I think it's I mean, actually, it's opened up loads of more questions, and I could probably talk to you for hours longer, but this is supposed to be a focus podcast. But I really appreciate the insight. I think the Coastal Connections Initiative has just been fantastic and, you know, showcased by the numbers of people and countries, etc. And I really hope that that World Monuments Fund and English Heritage, or anybody else that's out there that wants to fund, will continue, because it really is an initiative that should be supported. So thank you so much.
Thanks very much indeed, Lucy. It's been a real pleasure. Thanks a lot.
That was really interesting and shows how Coastal Connections is truly making an impact, bringing awareness to threat, finding solutions and working towards managing heritage sustainably. So thanks to Alex and all our contributors to this mini series on climate threat and maritime cultural heritage. Thank you for listening to the Dive and Dig podcast, brought to you by the Honor Frost Foundation, a charity that supports the development of maritime archaeology in the Eastern Mediterranean. But this is not the end of the podcast. We have got more to come, so I hope you'll tune in again in a couple of weeks.